You know, a good story, you know, I've talked about the value of a good story, but a good story usually includes tension, right, or a conflict of sorts. When I say a conflict, I don't mean a physical conflict, but usually good versus bad, right versus wrong, something like that, a type of conflict and a resolution. That's a good story. And if you think about the makeup of a story, you'd probably realize that that's usually the case. Well, today I'd like to tell a story about a person in the Bible. His name is well known, but this man faced a dire situation. In fact, it was very dire. It was so dire that it seemed unwinnable without miraculous and divine intervention. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about a set of Psalms known as the Songs of Ascent, and I referenced a story that would really help illustrate Psalms 124 and 125. And those are two Psalms that talk about trusting God in situations in which deliverance simply wouldn't happen without Him. And I said I was going to, if I used that story, then I would have to summarize it so much that I decided not to do that, because it's a great story and it needs a little bit of detail, I think, because the background in it is very, very interesting. I'd like to start by setting the stage of what, and in this case, who, made the situation so dire. Again, very dire and very frightening. It's a story we know, but I want to give a few more details. Now, at the time of our story, the Assyrian Empire, I'm sure we've heard that, the Assyrian Empire had been a powerful force in the ancient world for hundreds of years, although their power ebbed and flowed. Their most powerful time was in the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries BC, or I should say the 9th, 8th, and 7th centuries BC, roughly from 900 BC to 612 BC. That's when they were at the zenith of their power. This was the period in which the Assyrians took the northern 10 tribes of Israel captive and relocated them out of their homeland. And we've probably heard that story many times. The Assyrian Empire was actually very closely aligned and tied to Babylon. And we've heard about the Babylonian Empire. In fact, the Assyrian society likely started from immigrants from the neighboring territory of Babylon, you know, long before they reached their zenith of power. Now, their religion was also very similar. The Assyrians were polytheists, so they believed in many gods, but their chief god was named Asher. Now, their power, the Assyrians' power, ebbed and flowed because it was so centered on the leader of the moment, the king. Now, one king in particular from the 1100s BC was named Tiglath-Pileser. Now, there's not going to be a quiz at the end, but there was more than one Tiglath-Pileser. I like to say Tiglath-Pileser. But he did a lot to normalize their society, to take it out from being so reliant on a king. And he put into place processes and practices of a sustainable nation state that wouldn't be as reliant on the particular leader of the moment. The time period during this king's reign is referred to as the Old Assyrian Empire, but it was very important. After his life, the empire did decline again for a while, but it did reemerge because of some of his institutions, which we'll get to. It's an important part of our story. Now, one of the key things that this particular king did, Tiglath-Pileser, was to create one of the very first standing armies. What do I mean by that? Until that time, armies were mainly militias with some professional soldiers. Now, militias were mainly comprised of peasant farmers and tradesmen, whatever. It was like, okay, everyone, we got to go fight a war. So they were made up of peasant farmers with some elite and wealthy members of society as the more sophisticated soldiers, but primarily peasant farmers, and others who were not professional. Because of this makeup in an agrarian society, you might realize that these armies were limited to seasonal war campaigns because they were farming in the spring and early summer. So a standing army of professional soldiers from Assyria and its vassal states was an unbelievably powerful weapon. Plus, Assyria was the first to make its army wear matching uniforms. Who cares about that? Who cares about matching uniforms? It inspired nationalism, and it also inspired fear, because they also had matching weaponry and machinery, like chariots. There wasn't a ragtag feel to this. This wasn't your normal army. This was a professional standing army, and it was huge. It was huge. From the website realmofhistory.com, they had chariots. Now, we've all seen chariots. The chariots were the ultimate shock weapon, drawn by four horses and carrying four soldiers. So you can imagine, if you can paint it in your mind, somebody, they're all standing, and it's a pretty massive chariot. One's probably driving, and three are fighting. They're either shielding, or they're shooting bows and arrows, or they have hatchets. But it's a massive weapon, and it wreaked havoc as a boisterous and destroying weapon, as the site says. They also had a shield and archer system. Now, the longbowmen or the archers were some of the fiercest weapons of Assyria. They were guarded by a spearman, so it was a two-person team. They were guarded by a spearman with a full-length shield. So the bow and arrow person is there, but there's somebody with a full-length shield made of a special kind of reed that stood in front of this bowman, this long bowman. And in fact, this was such an important thing. They had a special area that they grew these reeds, because these long shields were very important. So they had this shield and archer system, but they also were very, very good at siege warfare. In other words, they could go into a walled city and they would seal it off, so eventually they would starve out the people inside the walls. So they were very good at that. And there's evidence still of a rampart or a mound that the Assyrians built to ascend the walls of a city named Lachish or Lachish, which was a primary city of Judah. Now, the sheer size of this army was unheard of at that time, or even after, for hundreds of years. Many people were never able to replicate it. This will be an important element of our story as we go along. Now, you think about, well, this army, how big could it have been? Well, if you think of forward 700 years, and we know of Julius Caesar, who was still considered one of the very best generals who ever led an army. When he fought in his infamous battle, the Siege of Alesia, if you've heard of that, he had perhaps generously 75,000 to 90,000 soldiers. That was a big army at the time. He used it very, very well. I won't get into a lot of the things that made him special, but that was 700 years afterwards. And the Assyrian army, 700 years before, was much larger, and it was professional. It wasn't farmers. It was really powerful soldiers who were uniformed. Now, let's fast forward from the time of the old Assyrian Empire, during which Tiglath-Pileser created the standing army, what is now known as the new Assyrian Empire. It's about 300 years later. Now, this is the one that conquered Israel, this new Assyrian Empire. And this army was a war machine. It was a machine. The Assyrians tormented and fought Israel a few times long before they actually conquered Israel. In fact, they're mentioned in the Bible a couple of times. About 130 years before they conquered Israel, they fought against Ahab. Remember Ahab, Jezebel's husband? They fought against him, and that's recorded in the Bible. It's also referenced that the king of Israel, Omri, paid tribute to the Assyrians. So they had been around for a while. Again, from this site, the Realm of History, interesting here to talk about a little bit about their nature. Historian Simon Anglim said about the ancient state of the ascendant Assyrians, they were an aggressive and murderously vindictive regime supported by a magnificent and successful war machine. As with the German army of World War II, the Assyrian army was the most technologically and doctrinally advanced of its day and was a model for others for generations afterwards. The Assyrians were the first to make extensive use of weaponry, iron weaponry, and not only were iron weapons superior to bronze, but could be mass-produced, allowing the equipping of very large armies indeed. Now, many historians consider this new Assyrian empire the world's first superpower. And guess who's right in their way? Israel and Judah. Now, what were the people like? What were the Assyrian people like? Trying to set the stage for our story here. From Unger's Bible Dictionary, it says, the Assyrians intermarried little with neighboring peoples and held it a subject for much boasting that they were of purer blood than the Babylonians. So the Babylonians were right next to them. In stature, the Assyrians were of average modern European height and were powerfully built. Their complexion was dark, the nose prominent, the hair, eyebrows, and beard thick and bushy. They, and remember that, so we'll focus and help you paint the picture here in a few minutes. They were apparently of cheerful disposition, given to mirth and feasting, but of implacable cruelty. The pages of history are nowhere more bloody than in the records of their wars. They also employed a frightfulness as a key element in their conquest. The utter terror and ruthlessness was very effective. This was a huge professional army that was cruel and terrifying. The world had seen nothing like this before, ever. And again, even 700 years later, in the great battles that Julius Caesar fought, they had pulled some lessons, but they never really got the same size. Now, this is our setting for one side of the story, and you might think we will cover how the Assyrians conquered the northern 10 tribes of Israel, and we will touch on that. However, the story I want to focus on today is the one involving the Assyrian army and King Hezekiah of Judah. It's a story we'll recognize. I like to read about Hezekiah. He was the 13th king of Judah. So obviously, after Solomon's death, Israel split up into the northern 10 tribes and Judah, and there were several kings of Judah, and Hezekiah was the 13th king. And it's widely agreed that Hezekiah and Josiah were the best kings of Judah in the whole reign. 2 Kings 18. Let's go to 2 Kings 18. We'll read a little bit about him. Now, I think if we read about him, we would want ourselves, in fact, we would be pretty pleased, I think, if something like this was written about us. What does it say about him? What does the Bible record about King Hezekiah? 2 Kings 18, verse 1. Now, it came to pass in the third year of Hosea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. Now, his father, Ahaz, it doesn't say it here, but Ahaz was not a good king. In fact, he was a servant to Assyria and even adopted their religion. He got rid of any of the altars for God or any of the religious practices for God and actually brought in the Assyrian religion and worshipped Asher. Verse 2, he was 25 years old when he became king and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. Now, one thing I noticed about this, if it was a good king or a fairly good king, it mentioned the name of the mother. Tells you a lot, I think, because his father, when it talked about Ahaz, it didn't mention his mother. It just mentioned who he was. But of the good kings, it mentions his mom. Again, you can read into that what you want. I think that means, obviously, that the mother had something to do with his character. Now, she was the daughter of Zechariah, and Hezekiah did what was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. Verse 4, he removed the high places. Even the other good kings, they didn't remove the high places, the, the pagan altars. And he broke the sacred pillars, cut down the wooden image, and broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. So the bronze serpent, as you might recall from earlier writings, was actually created by Moses when there were lots of poison serpents around, and it was there as a sign that those who were faithful to God would be healed or protected from these serpents. Now this would had been around for a long time, but the Israelites had started worshiping it. Now if you look at, a lot of people believe, and I think this is probably accurate, if you see the symbol today of medicine, the doctor, it's a pole with a serpent on it. Very likely and almost without any doubt, it's from this. But he tore that down. And that's important too. We'll see that in a few minutes. And it says he tore it down because until those days, the children of Israel burned incense to it and called it Nehashtan. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor who were before him. That was allowed to be put into the Bible. Who was before him? He was something else. He was probably a little bit underappreciated, if you think about it. Verse 6, for he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Lord had commanded Moses. The Lord was with him. He prospered wherever he went, and he rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him, unlike his father. Meanwhile, the northern 10 tribes. So now we're, again, just think of who's in the area. This massive professional army that the world had never seen anything like, and even afterwards. It's a terrifying time. And meanwhile, the northern 10 tribes, we won't turn there, but Hosea of Israel attempted to revolt against Assyria, and the new emperor, another, we don't get to say Tiglath-Pileser again, but Shalmaneser the V, laid siege to the Israelite capital of Samaria, and before he could fully capture it, his son took the reins of power, Sargon II, whose new regime was inaugurated by the fall of Samaria. So the northern 10 tribes had fallen, and then Sargon's son is who's going to be the chief antagonist in our story, is Sennacherib. Sennacherib was now the king. So what happened? So northern 10 tribes, most historians will agree, they fell around 722 BC. About 8 years later, and you can show this in the chapters of 2 Kings, about 8 years later, Sennacherib has what is called the first invasion. And we won't spend a lot of time on that. But we'll start here, still in 2 Kings 18, verse 13. And in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah. So he was threatening Judah, right? So all the cities, there were probably about 46 of these cities that were fortified. And he took them. So Sennacherib, in this first invasion, took all of these cities. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. Again, this city at Lachish was the second most important city in all of Judah. And it guarded a really important road between Egypt and Jerusalem. So he had taken all the fortified cities, including the second most important city. So what did Hezekiah do? He said and sent a letter to him, I have done wrong. Turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will pay. And the king of Assyria assessed Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And, you know, you could maybe point to this as not a great example of Hezekiah, but on the other hand, he was trying to avoid a fight. And we know from him already that he didn't, you know, he would take down the bronze serpent. He wasn't bothered about physical things. But he's not condemned in the scripture here for doing this, but what did he do? Verse 15, so Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. So that seems to have kind of taken care of it for a while, but it's not over because Sennacherib comes back a few years later, about 13 years later, around 701, he comes back. So let's go to verse 17 here. And this is the siege of the city that begins. Now we're getting into our main story. Then the king of Assyria, verse 17, sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshaka. So of these three people, think of these as like, now this is not exactly right, but let's assume if the U.S. is going to send not the president, but maybe it's the vice president, the secretary of state, and maybe the leading general of the army, right? It's really three top people, even though the Rabshaka does most, if not all, the talking. There are three of them. So they were probably the commander-in-chief, the chief officer, and maybe the chief of staff. And they were in Lachish, so he sent them from there. And again, this is an indication that maybe Sennacherib didn't ever fully relinquish control of all these cities for 13 years. The scripture's not clear, but it could this have been an ongoing threat that was always on the edge. We don't know. But anyway, he sent them with a great army. These three men, they were the ones who were going to be his spokesperson. He sent them with a great army against Jerusalem to King Hezekiah. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. When they had come up, they went and stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool, which was on the highway to the fuller's field. So let's go to Isaiah 36 now. This story is so important that there's two almost exactly the same accounts of this very story. And here in 2 Kings 18 and also in Isaiah 36 and 37. It's also referenced and with fewer details in 2 Chronicles. This is an important story. So there's some lessons here that we can learn. Isaiah 36, verse 2, then the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh. Now, Isaiah's account only references one of these people. It doesn't reference the other two. That's why I wanted to read the one verse in 2 Kings. It's here that he only mentions the Rabshakeh, who, again, does almost all of the talking, if not all the talking. Sent him with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah Judah, and he stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. So, and now picture this. So now all the other fortified cities have been taken, right? And they're in Lachish, so they have the number two city, and they send down this massive army. And we know later, because you know the story, there were at least 185,000 soldiers. That doesn't mean it was all of them. And so they're all in uniform. Their weaponry is the state of the art. No one's ever seen it. And then you have these three leaders of the country, and one of them is really pompous, and he does all the talking. So paint the picture. And so they're around the wall of the city, and a lot of the people from Judah are lining the top of the wall to hear it, right? And so it's all, the story is right there. This great superpower, nobody had ever seen anything like it. They're right outside your door. This is a dire situation. What does Hezekiah do? But first, let's listen to the story from the Rabshakeh. Verse 3, and Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. So he's out there standing on top of the aqueduct, and what does he start to say? He starts insulting King Hezekiah and trying to scare all the people, including the three representatives that Hezekiah had sent out. Verse 4, then Rabshakeh said to them, say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? I say you speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words, insulting. Now in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Look, you are trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, which we assume they probably had a loose confederation, or on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. Verse 7, but if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar, the one altar for God? So he's referring to that Hezekiah took away all the high places and the serpent, the bronze serpent. He had taken that away. So now he's telling, probably playing to the fears of these folks who probably maybe believe that as well. Like, oh, really? You're right. You're right. So he's implying that Hezekiah has offended God and God won't protect you. Even if he could, he won't, because Hezekiah has taken down all the altars. Verse 8, now therefore, I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you, now this is really insulting. You give a pledge, and I'll give you 2,000 horses. Well, that sounds nice, but what does he say? If you are able on your part to put riders on them. He's saying, you don't even have people that could ride these horses well enough to threaten my weakest company of soldiers. I can give you 2,000 horses. Horses were very valuable, but I wouldn't even be afraid of that because you don't have people that can ride them. This is how weak you are, he's saying. Verse 9, how then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Have I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. So now he's saying, God told me to come here. All these people have got to be frightened. Now remember, we'll see here in a minute, there are people on the wall listening to this. And if you think they're scared, even the three people standing in front of them are scared. Verse 11. Now Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. So what are they saying? Well, you know, many of us have heard that the language of diplomacy, you know, several decades ago was French, that all around the world, the people in the courts of the leaders of the world could speak French, and that was the diplomatic language. It's probably English today. No one will actually say that, but English is the language that most people speak. Well, they were saying, speak Aramaic so you don't scare the people on the wall. And the Rabshakeh, what do you think he does? What does he do? And they said, do not speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who were on the wall. Guess what he did? Verse 12. But the Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the man who sit on the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you? In other words, we've got you under siege, and you've seen what we built at Lachish. We can build a rampart here, and we're going to. Now, if you want to come on out, it'll be nicer for you. Come on out. And then in verse 13, it goes from persuasive and threatening, and then he starts speaking directly to the people. They said, don't speak to us in Aramaic. So verse 13, what does he do? Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out with a loud voice. So you can almost picture him there. Now, again, what does he look like? Probably has, you know, a prominent nose, bushy hair, and we assume that he may have dark hair. He has hair. I mean, that's pretty good to start with. Mr. Luganville and I are pretty, wish we had hair. But anyway, he's standing there, and he's so arrogant and pompous. And he says, hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you. He's speaking in Hebrew. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present, and come out to me, and every one of you shall eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree. In other words, come on out. If you come out now peacefully, it'll just follow me. It'll be fine. You'll get to have fig trees. You have your own. You can make your own decisions. And everyone will drink the waters of his own cistern. Verse 17, until I come and take you away to a land like your own homeland, a land of grain and new wine. And very much like they had just done a few years earlier with the northern 10 tribes. And a land of bread and vineyards. Now, here's a big mistake coming up. The Rabshakeh is getting ready to make a really big mistake here. What does he do? He argues that the God of Israel will be of no more use than the gods of the others who they had conquered. Verse 18, he says, blessed lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Israel from my hand? But they held their peace and answered him not a word. They were frightened, but they didn't say a word. For the king's commandment was, do not answer him. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn. They were scared, and we probably would be too. This massive army, like nothing anyone had ever seen, was there, and one of the leaders is scaring them to death. It's dire. It is dire. Just think about what the visual must have been. Again, this massive army. Now, how big was this army? Again, we know later that it's 185,000. Has anyone been to the new U.S. Bank Stadium for a game? I know some people have. Imagine three times the people that sit in U.S. Bank Stadium. That's about 185,000. Or the Rose Bowl in Pasadena would seat about 102,000. So nearly two times that. It's a lot of people. And they're not just regular people. They're trained to kill. They have weapons, and horses, and chariots. And they're coming after your little town. And Hezekiah, your king, says, no, no, no. God will protect us. We might be scared too. Isaiah 37. So it was, when King Hezekiah heard it, that he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the house of the Lord. Then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and elders of the priest, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz. And they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and rebuke and blasphemy, for the children have come to birth, but there is no strength to bring them forth. Now what does that mean? Well, Sansino's commentary says it's a metaphor for a critical moment which finds one utterly helpless or underprepared. Verse 4, it may be that the Lord your God will hear the words of the Rabshakeh. It may be, you know, he's saying this in his letter, or his communication to Isaiah. It might be that they'll hear the words of the Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. Now, we don't have to turn to Psalm 124, but I'll just read it. It's a very short psalm. I'll read it for you and see if it sounds familiar. Psalm 124. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, when men rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us alive. When their wrath was kindled against us, then the waters would have overwhelmed us. Remember, we talked about the power of water. Water's good, but we've seen what water can do even in the last few days. The stream would have gone over our soul, then the swollen waters would have gone over our soul. Let's back to Isaiah 37, verse 5. So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said to them, so he's speaking on behalf of God, thus shall you say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you have heard, with which servants. Now, the word servants here, think, oh, the Rabshakeh, but Sansino goes into it a bit further, and it says, the word servants here seems to be referring to young boys. Don't be afraid by empty boasting of irresponsible children. In other words, don't be afraid of the servants. They're nothing. Don't be afraid of them. Which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Verse 7, surely I will send a spirit upon him, and he shall hear a rumor. That's interesting. So he's saying that Sennacherib will hear a rumor. That's an interesting point. God can and does work in a variety of ways. He can affect how others act and react. Remember what he did to Pharaoh? It said he hardened his heart. He can affect what other people do. It's an interesting lesson, I think. It said, he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. So there's a prophecy. Does it take place? So, the Rabshakeh, verse 8, returned, So he left the battlefield, or the field around the walls of Jerusalem, and he found the king of Assyria warring against Libna. For he had heard that he had departed from Lachish. Now Lachish, I don't know, I've not been over there, have you? Is that how it's pronounced, one of those two? It's pronounced like that or something like it. It's about 100 miles from Jerusalem. So that's not an easy journey. Even, you know, we're planning for the Rapid City Feast, and I'm 100 miles, I was thinking, Sarah doesn't like to drive that much. There are four states I haven't been to in the U.S. Four. Alaska, and then Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. Do you know how close Wyoming is to Rapid City? Well, Devil's Tower is 106 miles. I've already looked it up, and I thought, I wonder if she'll ride that far to go, I'm going to go to Wyoming. I got to get at least one state off the list. Got to get, I don't care much as going to Alaska, but I'm going to go to Wyoming. Right, so Lachish was about 100 miles away. Now, we can drive there, and what's the speed limit there, 80 miles an hour? So you can go 90, right? So you can get there in an hour and a half. Well, Lachish to Jerusalem was quite a long journey for him, but he went there. When he returned, he found the king of Assyria warring against Libna. And the king heard, again, listen to this. Verse 9, the king heard, what did he hear? He heard a rumor concerning Tirhaka, king of Ethiopia. Now, who is this person? He was pretty powerful, too. This king of Ethiopia came to power about the same time as Sennacherib and was always antagonizing him, right? Just something about, it was always like poking him and trying to incite revolution among Sennacherib's vassals. So, you know, the king, Sennacherib, couldn't stand for that. So he was out fighting somewhere else. So he was distracted. He heard a rumor. But what did he do? What did he do here? So we'll read here. And the king heard concerning the king of Ethiopia. He has come out to make war with you. So when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah. Now he sent a message to Hezekiah. You know what this reminds me of? Maybe you remember this too. When I was growing up, there were seven kids. There was the first five, and that was one set of kids. And then a few years later, my sister and me, we fought a lot. And if we were ever home by ourselves, and like my sister Liz would call my dad, what would he say? When I get home, this is what I'm going to do to you, right? Or similar to, don't make me stop this car. Who's heard that? It's essentially what Hezekiah is saying here. What does he say? He sent messengers unto Hezekiah, saying, thus shall you speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Syria. In other words, I'll be there shortly, and you're going to get it. This was a big mistake, a really big mistake, because he starts talking about God and blaspheming God. And he starts repeating the same threats. Thus you shall speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Look, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands by utterly destroying them, and shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered those whom my fathers have destroyed, Gozan and Haran and Reseph and the people of Eden who were in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, and the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Hena and Iva? He's repeating the same threats. And Hezekiah received the letter. And again, this has probably been a threat for many years, probably for 13 years, and it's really coming to a head. And again, the army was terrifying. Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it, and Hezekiah went to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. Here is the great prayer of Hezekiah. And it's a prayer that we can remember and we can recall and we can use when we face a dire situation. Hezekiah prayed to the Lord, saying, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God. Truly, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. In other words, Father, they're nothing like you. Therefore, they destroyed them. Now, therefore, O Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord, you alone. Not a long prayer, a powerful prayer, and one that God heard. Verse 21, then Isaiah, the son of Amoz, sent to Hezekiah, saying, thus says the Lord God of Israel, because you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, this is to Sennacherib, has despised you, laughed you to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head behind your back. In other words, they stood up to you because of their faith in God. This great superpower was turned away, not just by a small city with a wall around it, with a king that didn't seem very powerful. Verse 23, whom have you reproached and blasphemed? In other words, whom have you really offended? You can speak that way to my servant Hezekiah, but whom have you really offended? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes on high? Against the Holy One of Israel. Really big mistake on Sennacherib's part. By your servants you have reproached the Lord and said, by the multitude of my chariots, I have come up to the height of the mountains, to the limits of Lebanon. I will cut down all its cedars and its choice cypress trees. He's saying, you were boasting. I will enter its farthest height to its fruitful forest. I have dug and drunk water, and with the soles of my feet I have dried up all the brooks of defense. Did you not hear long ago how I made it? This is God speaking to him. From ancient times that I formed it, now I have brought it to pass. In other words, he's saying, I've brought it to pass. I've given you the power to wreak the devastation you have. God sets the boundaries. God sets the people in power. God is ultimately in charge, and he's saying this here, that you should be for crushing fortified cities into heaps of ruins. Therefore, their inhabitants had little power. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as the grass of the field, as the green herb, as the grass on the housetops, and grain blighted before it is grown. But I know your dwelling place, your going out and your coming in, and your rage against me. Because your rage against me and your tumult have come to my ears, therefore I will put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. Have you ever seen an ox or even a large bull with a nose, with a ring in its nose? Right? This massive 2,000 or 3,000 pound animal can be led around with a ring, because if you bring the head, the body will follow. And he's essentially saying, I'm going to lead you around like an oxen. Verse 30, now this is addressing Hezekiah. This shall be a sign to you. You shall eat this year such as grows out of itself. This is a miracle, if you think about it. Why would that be a miracle? It says, you shall eat this year such as grows of itself. Where do you think they would grow their crops? They would grow it outside the wall, almost without a doubt. What's been out there? What's been out there? Do you know how much it takes to feed an army? One of the reasons that you couldn't have an army in the ancient world is the supply chains. How are you going to feed an army that big? They were out there, so the land was probably pretty much ruined. The terrain had been ruined. It says, you shall eat this year such as grows of itself, and the second year what springs from the same. So I'm giving you a miracle. And then in the third year, sow and reap. Plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. And the remnant who have escaped the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. Because they had been under this power for a long time. For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and those who escape from Mount Zion, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Therefore, says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria. So this is about the king, not necessarily to him, but about him. He shall not come into the city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shield. nor build a siege mound against it. That's what he was really good at. He was good at all those things. By the way that he came, and again, Sennacherib had come back now from this fighting the king of Ethiopia. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and he shall not come into the city, says the Lord, for I will defend the city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. So what happened? Now, this is the part of the story we know, but now we know a little bit more about this army. This was a frightening situation with a massive army, a professional army. Verse 36, then the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. We hear that number, and it might not seem a lot of soldiers today, but it is a large number. That's the equivalent of what's in the U.S. Army would call three field armies, not just a few battalions, dozens of battalions. That would be three full field armies that a four-star, five-star general, that's the level it would take to command that. And when people, it says here, 85,000, when people arose early in the morning, there were corpses everywhere, all dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. He got out of all of Judah, left Lachish, everything. He was gone. Now it came to pass, it's probably several years later, probably not right away, but it said it came to pass, as he was worshiping the house of Nisroch, his god, that his sons Adrammelech and Sharezah struck him down with a sword. He was killed by his own sons. Again, he heard a rumor that was prophesied, and he will be killed in his own land. And they escaped into the land of Ararat. Then Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. And it wasn't very long until Assyria completely, really, they lost almost all their power about 70, 80 years later because of the subsequent kings were weaker. And they gave way to the Babylonian Empire, and the Babylonian Empire, that's the one who actually eventually did capture Judah. And then they gave way to the Persian Empire with a great Cyrus, this magnificent leader who came out of nowhere. Nobody had heard of him. But this was the great Assyrian Empire. And Sennacherib, that great and threatening antagonist, was murdered by his own sons. It's, again, those other kingdoms soon came. But the lesson here is Hezekiah. This story is told three times in the Bible, with a lot of detail. There's a lot of detail here. And Hezekiah trusted God in a situation that was so dire that miraculous and divine intervention was the only way out. It was the only way out of the situation. And he delivered Hezekiah and Judah. That same God who is there for us today. When we're fighting spiritual battles, sometimes physical difficulties. You know, we are in the midst of the fall holiday season. I think of those songs of ascent. They were so beautiful. I thought this story would help illustrate Psalm 124 and 125 so well. And then Psalm 126 was the one where, you know, you come through the trial and you kind of like, wow, I came through that trial. I wonder what Hezekiah thought after that. We hear that he fell ill and he was granted a few more years of life. But as we're in the middle of the fall holiday season, we can think about these things. We have a great God who can protect us. That's who we're going to go rejoice and worship. We're going to rejoice at the feast. I thought that was a beautiful scripture that Mr. Franks read, talking. And it, to me, it's interesting that it was about, you know, leafy boughs and the palm tree, the fronds of a palm tree. I love trees. You know, the beautiful trees. I know I've told you before about the great white oak tree that we had. I thought of it this week as well, the great white oak tree we had in our house in Richmond, Virginia, because we had an inland hurricane come through there, Hurricane Fran, a number of years ago. And this massive tree just opened up and absorbed those 80 and 90 mile an hour winds. Beautiful tree. And so that verse that he talked about today, I thought was wonderful. And it's about trees and the beauty that God created. That's who we're going to go worship, the great God that we worship. And we'll do that here starting. Well, we're in the midst of that already, atonement and the feast. He created everything, and he can handle any trial that we can possibly fathom. So a wonderful story about Hezekiah, often told, but you know, the details of what he was really facing, but was a really wonderful story to share today.